killed the Tsar and its ministers. Anastasia screamed in vain. I rode a tank, held a general's rank when the blitzkrieg raged and the fighters sank. Pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife, Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Hey, Ian, how's it going?
Well, I know that you've you must be feeling kind of wretched about what's happening in Aleppo, given what an extraordinary historical heritage site the ancient souk is. It's apparently burning, and that it may simply cease to exist.
You know, of course, the human tragedy is foremost in my mind, but Aleppo, the souk, and the medieval city was truly world heritage. There's nothing else like it in the world. In the 80s, I used to walk through it. The smells, the spices, the the food stores. It was dark with the roof was sort of pierced, but it was all very. You just knew you were walking back 1,000 years. And so for this to burn, you know, brings home the reality of Syria for me. There is nothing good about what's happening there.
Well, the Amnesty International's lead researcher has been on her seventh trip behind the lines inside of Syria was just telling us that what she sees happening there is that all of the areas liberated by the Free Syrian Army, that the Syrian government is conducting indiscriminate bombing and shelling as a way, out of vengeance, as a way to essentially punish people for having this Free Syrian Army, liberate them, if that's the right term.
I wouldn't look at it being punished. It's for the people behind the guns, the Alawites, and a lot of Christians. For them, it's an existential war, and they intend to destroy their enemies and destroy their cities, destroy the country if they have to. They believe their backs are against the wall, rightly or wrongly. They see this led by Islamic militants, and it's just the facts of it just don't really matter right now. Because they're so paranoid and so vicious and so determined to survive that they have applied what I call Hama rules, which is they destroyed the medieval city of Hama in 1982, February. I visited that too, and if you want to see real destruction, you should have seen it then. It flattened the entire center of the city, another World Heritage City, simply because of this mentality of a minority, embattled minority, It's as I said, paranoid. They think the world's coming after them, and they'll just fight and fight and fight. I think if you're realistic about this, darkly realistic, I admit, you just have to efface Syria from the map in your minds. It's not a country anymore. You're going to see the Kurds who are in the northeast along the Iraqi border, the Turkish border. You're going to see that break off. You're going to see a tendency for Alawites to move back into the Alawite Mountain. You're going to see the Syrian insurgents wanting to take the old Sunni cities, and that would be Aleppo, Hama, Homs, and Damascus as well. That's their goal, to reestablish some, order that existed, during the caliphate, which was led by Sunni Muslims. You know, this all seems very primeval when I say it. I know it does. But when you get back in that area, I just came back from the Middle East, this is what they say. And what scares people in the Middle East is the conflicts like Libya and Syria and really Iraq as we see it still going on. They're spinning off a militant wing of Islam like we've never seen before, that is determined, as they call it, to conduct their own crusade against the West, colonialism, and any sort of, you know, 21st century progressivism and humanism. You know, there's very dire predictions what they're saying, and this group is maybe only 10% of people fighting, but they have an enormous influence simply because they're willing to murder and kill, as we saw in Benghazi.
But this is in Syria, surely it's not necessarily. It may be a result of Western colonialism and the French legacy of the French divide and conquer notion of putting a minority in charge, which is what the British also did. But the Assads are, of course, a homegrown dictatorship, are they not? So.
Well, I wouldn't look at it as a dictatorship. It's a minority community. No one particularly likes Bashar inside the Alawi community, but that's all there is. And the generals around him, he by default he rules that country, but he's running that country through what's called his promotion. When he went to military academy, it's officers he got to know, and there's maybe 25 of them, and they're conducting the reprisals, the shellings, running the Air Force, and the rest of it. So it's more of a military junta. And, you know, but it is. This is like Rwanda in 1994, where you had a minority ruling the country, been put in there by the Belgians forever, and then they turned, you know, then the majority turned against them. And this is what we're seeing in Syria, and it can be nothing but bloody. This is not to justify anything the regime is doing. I mean, destroying your own country is obviously not a solution, that you obviously lost the narrative if you think that that's going to save anybody. But I'm just explaining to you why a coup d'etat today would make absolutely no difference in Syria. You'd have these same generals fighting on the delusion that they can hold back history, and it is a delusion. And under that sort of delusion, they're almost unstoppable. And I mean, not unstoppable, they are stoppable on military force, but they're not going to give up easily.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. So what about the extent to which then it is a surrogate war between Iran and Saudi Arabia? That was disputed by our earlier guest from Amnesty International, who feels that it's really a homegrown struggle. But clearly, the Iranians are supplying the Assad regime apparently with a fairly consistent stream of aircraft flying in over Iraq. Apparently, the President of the United States got on the phone with the Iraqi leader that we put in power, al-Maliki, who apparently ignored the President's pleas to stop these overflights, making one, of course, remember how the absolute folly of the neoconservatives who got us into that war, where clearly the only winner of the Iraq war were the Iranians. You've got the Saudis and the Qataris pouring arms in as well, even though our previous guest said that there's not much evidence of any modern weaponry. Everything that she's seen on the ground has been old Soviet stuff.
Oh, I think she's absolutely right. I mean, I've heard the same reports. It's all light arms, rocket-propelled grenades. It's stuff that's been looted. It's stuff that deserters have taken across. It's stuff that's come over the border from Lebanon. And what they clearly need to tip the balance is surface-to-air missiles and anti-tank weapons, which they're not getting. I don't think the Gulf states have a way to get in. I don't think the Turks want the war to ratchet up to that effect, and it's certainly not a surrogate war. It was spontaneous. It happened. It's from years of oppression that the majority rose. But the way the Gulf looks at it, the Gulf Arabs and the Iranians, is this is their war too. Iran doesn't feel that it could lose Damascus in this greater war. And you know, I, as I said, I was out in the Gulf talking to officials, and their worst nightmare is that something's not done about Tehran, whether it's in Syria or against Iran itself. They put it this way. They said, look, if Iran normalized relations with the United States in some grand bargain, you combine that with Iraq and add up their oil, total oil production. I think this is high, but this is the figures they use. It's 15 million barrels a day, which will dwarf the Arabs. And one day, the United States will wake up and say, why do we need the Arabs? Let's go with Iran and its satellite Iraq. This is the kind of thinking that is driving the royal families in the Gulf to put money into the Syrian conflict, keep it going, destroy Syria. It's almost a balancing act with having lost Iraq to Iran. And if they look, we lost Iraq, but we'll take Syria away from Iran and we'll be even. And we'll take Lebanon away from Iran and we'll be more than even. It's a very crude way of looking at things, but that's the way they look at it.
Well, of course, we witnessed Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel at the United Nations with a kind of strange sort of Wile E. Coyote drawing of a bomb, drawing a red line on this cartoonish bomb, suggesting, according to Netanyahu's own beliefs, that Iran will cross a red line in the spring, meaning that Israel will do something. So that's an odd, isn't that a real wild card here in this? If you've got Iran determined not to lose, the Saudis determined not to allow Iran and Iraq to replace them as the dominant oil suppliers, what is Israel up to?
I don't think they can't attack. They can't attack, yes, but it would do no good at all. It would only push the Iranians faster. It would justify their getting a bomb in the world's eyes. You know, they would just go ahead and build it and test it. I think Israel knows that. The Israelis are not stupid. I think Bibi is scared the way the Middle East is going, this great shift of power, this hostility on his borders. This is all very fluid for them. And of course, look at it this way. You know, do we really need a third and fourth war in the Middle East now with the confusion? How long will it be before the Strait of Hormuz is closed? Our troops are tired. They've been fighting for 12 years now. Something like that. And there's nobody to fight these wars anymore. Afghanistan, mark my words, the roof's going to blow off in 2 weeks. It's going to be a messy, messy end to our departure in 2014. We don't know what to do about Libya, what to do about sub-Saharan Africa, and this country, frankly, can't withstand a very large regional war, which will entail Iran. And I think the Israelis understand in their hearts the last thing they want to do is draw the United States into a really, a truly crushing war that would bankrupt us if we got out of control. They don't want to do it. I think what Netanyahu wants to do is get the most concessions out of the United States as he can. Now, there are red lines to attacking Iran in Washington. I've heard one is that once the Iranians start simulating a nuclear bomb on a computer, that's really going to have to rethink things. But, you know, this is a total guess. And it's a piece of punditry that's probably worthless. But I think the Iranians like, you know, twisting the tail of the lion simply to get attention. The Iranians want us to believe they're going to make a bomb. It's a great negotiating tactic. They can go back to the table this spring after the elections here, say, all right, you know, the new president, you got 3 years. Here's the deal. We'll limit enrichment to 5%, we'll take anything enriched over and send it, you know, to Turkey to be, you know, all sorts of deals that could be worked out. So I think both Israel and Iran, and this is just a guess, are maneuvering for the post-election period. If
Well, you said a new president. I imagine
a new term. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say that
Obama's going to win.
I would have thought in the upcoming debates that there's no question that these questions will come up, will they not? And I would think that in a debate, given the hawkish views of Romney and reflecting those of McCain and others on the Republican side, that we should get into another war in Syria and another war perhaps against Iran, that Obama will have the stronger argument. Aren't the American people tired of these wars?
Oh, they're absolutely tired. There's nothing you can do, you know. And why? There's, you know, if anybody starts blaming this administration for the mess in the Middle East, they don't get it. You know, there's nothing we can do about Yemen. I mean, look at a map. Look at the geography. You can't do anything about it. Or look at northern Mali or Niger or Algeria, which a lot of this stuff is coming out of. And look at the mess in Libya, not being able to get the FBI in, because we couldn't send in a Marine division or whatever it would have taken to secure that consulate. I mean, if you don't get that, you don't get anything. Or the whole idea of sending five FBI agents with sidearms to retake the consulate is a fantasy. So I think that, you know, if we just, we can't be the Middle East police. We were never meant to be. We've taken sides with Israel, and that's based on not because of a lobby in this country, is because this country is driven by ideology, and that's democracy and progress and the perfectibility of man. And Israel, more than any country in the Middle East, represents that ideal. And I think a lot of Americans say, hey, you know, these guys are, yeah, they've got their faults, but they're ultimately like us, and they can be, you know, pulled into the 21st century, and the other guys can't. So, you know, it's this ideology has met reality in the streets of Libya and the streets of Damascus, and it's time we just take a realistic foreign policy. And when people are ready to start, you know, joining us in the 21st century, we will help where we can, but we cannot police them into doing this, and it really shouldn't be a political issue at all. The Obama administration should have come out on day one and said this was an organized attack on that consulate. You know, the moment the news came out that the mortars had hit the consulate, the annex, it was clear it had to have been organized. You simply don't bring in mortars on the first shot unless you've got people that are very well trained and know what they're doing and have been surveying the consulate. It's just a fact. So I think that the fact that the Obama administration doesn't want to deal with a new al-Qaeda threat in Libya, totally understandable, and I'm going to be happy when this election is over and we can get to reality in the Middle East, which is getting out of Afghanistan, you know, dealing with Iran, reaching that grand bargain, and doing anything we can to suppress things like what's happening in Syria, but ultimately knowing we are not going to determine the outcome.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. He is the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of a new article about three possible options that Israel might use in the war against Iran, the Entebbe option, how the U.S. military thinks Israel might strike Iran.
I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, burns, burns.